I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. On May 7th, a week after the rioting that plunged Baltimore into chaos, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake unveiled a campaign to, in her words, tackle systemic problems that have faced our city for decades, if not generations. She called the initiative One Baltimore, but we have not heard much about it since its creation. Today on Midday, we talk with Michael Cryer, former chair of the Maryland Democratic Party, now head of One Baltimore, to find out how the effort is going. Plus, how do people who live in Baltimore and its suburbs feel about the city's recovery from April's unrest? Are you worried about more unrest in the coming months? We'll take the city temperature today on Midday, Baltimore in recovery, after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. Our two-hour show, as usual, in the second hour today, David Zurawiec joining us for his monthly Midday on Media visit to our studio. We'll be talking about, Donald Trump, sort of hard-to-avoid media coverage of Donald Trump, Hillary Rodham Clinton. Also, Comcast, cable TV Comcast, the cable giant, announcing a new streaming service, trying to get in on the act of streaming entertainment. We'll be talking about that with David, and also he has some comments about Bill Cosby to share, following up on a column he wrote about Bill Cosby for The Sun. So that'll be in the second hour of our show today. And speaking of The Sun, in my column in The Sun on Sunday, I describe Baltimore as our city of perpetual recovery, our city in perpetual recovery, a city that it seems, while growing and by some perspectives and measures thriving, always seems to be in recovery from something. And recovery, a key word there, recovery from something, recovery from, we've talked about it on this show, I've written about it many times, the loss of good-paying manufacturing jobs in Baltimore over the last 50 years, recovering from loss of population, recovering from white flight, recovering from the 1968 riots, recovering from heroin addiction, that's still going on. The arrival of crack cocaine in our streets in the late 1980s, early 90s, recovering from an epoch of violence related to drug commerce that's still going on, all through the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and now into the 21st century. Some say even recovering from zero tolerance policing of the O'Malley era and its effects on people, many of whom are in recovery from the mass incarceration that resulted from zero-tolerance policing. So my thoughts about recovery, and I thought we would talk more about recovery today because Baltimore is in the midst of recovering from the unrest that hit the city in late April, and now the bloody surge in murders and shootings that have followed on our streets. And a lot of people are concerned, pessimistic, wondering about the city's future. On May 7th, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake unveiled a program she called One Baltimore, describing it as a campaign to tackle systemic problems that have faced our city for decades, if not generations. Today on the show, we welcome Michael Cryer, who was tapped by the mayor to head the One Baltimore effort to get it started. Michael Cryer is a former chair of the Maryland Democratic Party and is a strategic communications expert with the private consulting firm, the Cryer Group, LLC, and a number of high-profile clients, a longtime resident of Baltimore City, too, a graduate of Morgan State. Nice to have you on the show, Michael.
Yes, I'm glad to be here. Absolutely.
You know, when that program was announced, that effort initiative, we had you on the show just briefly to talk about it because there wasn't a whole lot to talk about yet. It seemed to be an idea that the mayor had, and she said even at the time she wasn't sure what it would become, but she was sure something was needed. She stood in front of the CVS at Penn and North, the destroyed CVS, and said that efforts to rebuild our city from inside out was a top priority. So I'm wondering now, 2 months later?
A bit more than two months later,
have you got a better idea about what One Baltimore is or can be?
I'm beginning to get a fairly good sense of that now. A couple of things I'm sure we're not. We're not a campaign, and we're not a program. This has to be a platform for sustainability. The very point you made earlier about this persistent recovery mode that we've been in, in part, I think, begins and starts each time because we're not connecting the dots nearly as well as we should. We have, I think, fairly extraordinary resources here, our foundations and our private sectors, our anchor institutions, and the citizens of Baltimore are great people, and we do great things. But I think to a fault, we operate in silos. We take ownership of our spaces, and the degree to which collaboration does not occur or should occur is in part responsible for our having to rediscover so often things that in many cases have the potential for longevity and a better trajectory. So I'm suggesting that we commit more to having a far better understanding of what, in fact, is here. Understanding what those resources are, where they are, whether or not we have over-concentration in some areas, sparsely represented resources in others. And it isn't simply the responsibility of any one sector. We all have to find a way to collaborate. I don't think we make any sustainable progress here unless we find a way to address our employment issue. We can create all kinds of things that appear to fix that problem. But if a person is not working, if a family is not generating its own income, it loses the control of those very things that are a part of our country that make men and women feel a partner.
Would you say that subject's been the most prominent that you've heard expressed since the riot?
I think so. I think that there is an intensity to the need for work. People want to be engaged. People want to... I mean, frankly, our drug economy in many ways is a parallel universe to the absence of being able to participate in the larger economy. And so we, in the world that we know, if we do, if we want to buy a company or merge a company, it's a merger acquisition. Unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of merger acquisitions on the corners that ended violence. And so we're going to have to find a way to channel that energy, that need, into real productivity.
Have you thought that out a little bit, what you do about employment, how One Baltimore might coordinate efforts that go on at, you know, job readiness, workforce development? We hear about all those things. I know I can name nonprofits around the city and the region that are involved in those efforts.
I think it's a combination of things. First of all, I certainly love the notion of workforce development. But I don't enjoy it. I don't love it if it's not connected to the likelihood of real work. I think we create an unrealistic expectation, if not disappointment, if we can't create some continuity and relationship between that development and the potential for real jobs. What I am seeing and frankly excited about, in part by what we are discovering out of the White House Office of Innovation and Technology, there is, I think, a real potential for transformation with the ability to take young people, many of whom have been disconnected from traditional education, who have had many challenged experiences. They are performing at extraordinary levels in the world of IT training, many of whom are now working for places like Google. Young woman that I shared with you who
go ahead,
was
please.
In a, I think Deborah was Destiny Thompson, a young woman who spent time in a homeless shelter with two kids, is now certified at a very high level, a CompTIA A+. I'm not a techie, but I understand that means something.
How'd she get there?
Well, there is a program here. A gentleman by the name of Lance Lance Lucas, who runs a company, Digital. And Lance is a really special guy who, frankly, the White House has adopted as his program and his concept for how we get at and commit to training the disconnected, frankly, has become the backbone, I think, of the White House Office on Innovation and Technology as it relates to this tech hire program that we've been talking about. Young people making real money, many of whom did not go to college. And I'm a strong advocate of colleges. And
so what would be your role? What would be the role of One Baltimore in that?
Well, I think it's two or three things that we do. First of all, it's encouraging more and more of the private sector to recognize this. And then many private sector companies now who are buying in, who understand. What we're learning about the private sector is they want productivity. They want people who deliver. Mm-hmm. They want people who understand both the soft skill, the hard skills, and I don't care, they say, what you did. If you show up every day and you can do the work, let's get it done.
I was going to say, they want them to show up to and on time.
That's exactly right.
Which gets us to transportation in a moment. We'll
talk about
that. That's another piece
it's
of
another,
it.
That's yeah. another issue. It's okay. another big issue.
Okay, so you see yourself.
So we are connecting the dots. We are creating relationships, bringing people together, creating platforms, and I think to some degree we also have a responsibility, if not us, certainly many of the communications resources in our city, is to begin sharing and communicating to the larger public that the view of young black and brown boys in particular and young men is quite skewed, that the vast universe of young men, many of whom are extraordinarily talented, wake up every day with the same vision and hopes and aspirations that we have. And so we need to communicate very differently what this broader community is like, because it makes it very difficult for the world to appreciate that what they saw on television does not represent the full community.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, despair does not conform to etiquette.
Right.
You know, there is pain there. And so we don't want to dismiss that as if it were somehow bizarre. It is real.
I'm curious about something in this regard in terms of the private sector, businesses. Have you heard from people who said, I want to help in some way?
Absolutely.
Has that been expressed? We've had, you know, Don Fry's been here from the Greater Baltimore Committee talking about what the GBC is willing to do or wants to do. But I wonder, you know, just what, Michael Cryer, what have you heard you got involved?
I hear
the
same things, of course. I think that people want to be involved, and I think people are feeling two things. First of all, they do appreciate that this requires a collaborative investment from all of us. But I also think that the business community and others began to recognize that what they may have thought was a distant problem, a problem unrelated to their unique world and circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
If left unaddressed, we all begin to suffer in ways that we never anticipated. And so I think there's
a
sense of
a lot of people
say,
have thought about that already, don't you? Started to look around and say, you know, we can't have this. This is our city. This is where I've invested in my business, my home. I put my kids in school.
Yes.
The difference is
now I think people are saying, I don't have an option not to.
Right.
I have to find a way to connect to the solution.
Now, have you really heard that? Because, you know, the other side of my head, the other ear, I can hear people saying, I've had enough of this. I'm getting out of here. Don't expect any further investment from us.
I'm certain that there are lots of folk who say that. I've spoken with people who've said that. But I think far more than that percentage of people, there are people who want to dig in and figure out a way to help. I think what we have to do, which is part of the sense of urgency I'm feeling, is to provide some strategic sense of how one makes that kind of collective, shared, collaborative investment.
Mm-hmm.
And so this issue of how we train, first of all, identify, train both in the hard and soft skills, young people who want to work and who obviously have the aptitude to do this, because you have to have aptitude. And there's no substitute for training. People can't simply walk off the street. But we have to shorten that gap between the wanting to work, the need to work, and that opportunity.
Right.
You know,
right.
We have to be able to do that.
Before we go to this break, along those lines, Michael Cryer, I wanted to ask you about My Brother's Keeper.
Mm-hmm.
This is a White House initiative. This is President Obama's initiative.
Yes.
What is it, and could we see it here?
Well, we do. There's an application that Baltimore has filed It has, frankly, it's you'll be happy to know that I think Baltimore is one of 26 cities who have applied and
for
have
a grant. It's a grant.
Yes,
it's money.
It will be
to
eventually.
To do what?
Well, it's I think it focuses primarily on entrepreneurship, but it's also a way to galvanize and cause this collaboration around resources
for young men.
For young men,
right?
Yeah. And building the sense of brotherhood and connection with a focus eventually on entrepreneurship and work. And so Baltimore
the idea is to get young guys, to get young guys to finish school or whatever training they need to get to a job.
Absolutely. At some point, you have to get up to a point where you have reached a point of completion, some aspect of education, some aspect of certification, some aspect of continued continuity of whatever your investment might be. Mm. And while we may have great affection for 4-year schools and 2-year schools, we have an audience that that frankly needs access to a larger variety of resource and opportunity.
Michael Cryer is our guest in this hour of Midday. He's head of the One Baltimore effort initiative. We won't call it a program or a campaign. An effort to coordinate all the good things that go on here in Baltimore all the time toward the end of improving the city and helping the city recover from what we just experienced here in the spring. And I want to ask you, our audience, to participate in this conversation because I am wondering, we are sort of taking the temperature of the city and the region today, people who live nearby, too. How do you feel about Baltimore's recovery from this? Are you concerned about the future, where we're going here, 410, just in the next few months, maybe? Or have you pitched in to help in some way? And if you have a question for Michael Cryer, please, this is the time to give us a ring during this short break, 410-662-8780, or write some comments. Share your feelings by email. That's midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Michael Cryer, who was tapped by Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake to run the One Baltimore effort here in Baltimore City. Has been in place since May 7th, but just now getting to an office. Actually, you have an office now?
We have an office.
You know, you said to me the first time we talked about this is you just didn't want to just jump in and say, okay, this is what it is. You weren't sure at the time what it was supposed to be.
That's
so
correct.
You have a better idea today that you're, it sounds like you'd be a connect-the-dots agency of some kind.
That's exactly right. You know, in many cases, every time I said, gee, boy, we ought to do that. I don't see an entity that's doing that. And in 2 seconds, there's an entity that you discover that there's a group that's doing that, or several groups are doing that. And so it became very obvious that.
But has there ever been like one organization in the city that said, okay, we're going to gather together under one huge umbrella, all these nonprofits, folks who are working with in drug addiction, workforce development, housing, transportation, so we know what everybody in the city is doing, and they can meet once in a while or know better about other organizations and sort of cross-connect. You know what I mean? I don't know that we've ever had that.
That is what we dare to do.
Yeah, sounds like it.
To do a kind of asset mapping that identifies this huge volume of resources and talent in these various sectors. The other part of that, then, is to try to create a metric system, a measurement system that allows us to track and to demonstrate what the level of productivity and success might be.
A lot of people say job number one or problem number one to face up to is the community's relationship with its police department here in Baltimore City, a police department in disarray that's gone through a transition now of leadership. The police department that certainly has its hands full dealing with the surge in violence since the unrest. I mean, it's been a remarkable few months here.
It really has.
What can you tell us about that, police matters, when it comes to One Baltimore? Do you even see that as part of your mission?
I can't imagine that our city will buy in nearly as well if we are not working and if we don't feel safe. And so public safety is a critically important part of this. I've had the privilege of sitting with Congressman Cummings in conversations with our rank and file, and we've spoken with officers, and clearly there is a sense of real disconnection and disenchantment, and obviously there's great hope that that the interim commissioner can create a better climate for healing.
Hmm. What was the conversations like with Congressman Cummings? He actually met with officers to find out what's on their minds?
Yes.
When was this, Michael? How recently?
It's been two, three, four weeks. Okay. 2 or 3 weeks. And he's such a special human being. He has such great credibility that their confidence in talking with him, their trust, was important. And so you got the real sense that they were sharing. And he wasn't out to do anyone harm at all, but simply to understand what he could do to try to improve what was going on. And I think there was this overwhelming sense of disappointment and feeling lost and disconnected from leadership and what have you. So there's a lot of blame to go around. So I don't want to suggest that the officers don't have a role in the challenges we face or the leadership. But I do know that if we're ever going to get to the kind of reform that's required, we're going to have to include in that a very meaningful level of community engagement. And by that, it's a kind of equity in both training, operation, and reporting out. It also requires that community assumes a role for connecting with its own community.
Hmm. Well, it's a tough one. Have you thought about how One Baltimore might figure into that?
Well, not yet. And I'm not eager to answer every question and to have an answer for everything.
Okay.
We do think that ultimately we're going to have to get into that. I've had the privilege of working as a consultant with the New York City Police Department as they consider the reengineering of that department for a very short time. What I did learn and was able to contribute to in some way is the sense that that department has to, it's made a commitment to being, to getting police out of the cars, to making the district smaller, to having an officer in the same district every day.
Mm-hmm. I've been reading about this under Mayor de Blasio.
So the relationships develop when people have that kind of connection. They have access to smartphones now. Every policeman has a smartphone. So they get information, and they have information about situations quicker than they can get it from a dispatcher, which means they get to a situation with more information, and are less likely to make assumptions, which often lead to bad situations.
Might you be making some recommendations here like that?
Well, I would not without knowing what is already here, but mm-hmm. I would urge that we think seriously about taking a very strong and a holistic look at our department and its resources.
Let's take a couple of calls while Michael Cryer is with us. I have a couple more questions when it comes to public safety. I also want to talk to you about education and ex-offenders, people coming back, or some are known as returning citizens. Coming out of prison, coming back to our communities here. And we have a couple of questions from folks who want to know how they can help. So
that's fine.
We'll get into that in a minute. Ryle, is it Ryle in Towson?
Ryle and Towson, thanks, Dan.
Hi.
Quick question. I think it's kind of spurious to argue that training and more money and programs are going to help the youth. I think what's happened is, from my point of view, things like NAFTA and a new PPA, the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, has sucked all the jobs out of the country. And as we well know, there's a high percentage of people are only good for factory work, and the factory has disappeared. So how can you recover with our national government destroying our job structure?
All right. We'll go back to that subject maybe of tech training or wherever you want to go with that answer, Michael.
Well, I think certainly there is a lot to be said about what the impact of national federal policy is and what it has done to a number of industries, and many of those industries were great suppliers of work. But we can't sit on our hands. We've got to do something with what we have. And I think part of the new frontier is what we can do in the world of technology, not all of which requires extraordinary training. And part of what we were saying in the beginning was that as we begin to identify what we can do, particularly with the workforce that we're talking about, the Freddie Grays of Baltimore, people who want to work, there are real opportunities. There are 350,000 vacancies in cyberspace alone.
In the United States.
In the United States. But this is a major.
There's a bunch in Maryland that have been identified by the Baltimore Metropolitan Council, the Opportunity Collaborative, that have talked about those middle-skilled jobs.
Middle-skilled jobs. Absolutely right. And it does not take forever to become credentialed in those spaces. So we cannot solve the problem, obviously, of our national policy with respect to what causes jobs to come and go. But where there are opportunities to create work, we must and we will. We are very fortunate, though, to have, I think, a community that wants to help and do that. We've got partners. I'm thrilled with the work that Johns Hopkins has done and Ron Daniels and Don Fry. Ron Daniels, president, and Patrick McCarthy, who is at the Casey Foundation, who is particularly concerned and invested in this whole issue of how we create new opportunities for our disconnected youth.
I appreciate Ryle's point about that, but you're right. You just can't sit here and say, well, it's too bad.
It's too bad. Right. Yeah, we can't do it.
We'll go to Annapolis for the next call. Don, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan. Really enjoy your show. As you recall, I called some time ago and stirred up quite a hornet's nest.
You did, because you said you were afraid to come to Baltimore to eat in a restaurant on Charles Street. Yeah.
Actually, I didn't say I was afraid. I said I was concerned.
Oh, okay.
Because well, I think there's a difference. And because I said I was concerned about the police standing down, and now that's become a topic of conversation, shall we say.
Right.
I just wondered for your guest. I listened to your young man, and I'm very sorry, I can't remember his name, the head of the 300-man march, who's very articulate.
Yeah, Munir Bahar.
Yeah, and he said the programs of the past 40 or 50 years, all the programs for jobs have not worked. And I just wondered what's different about this initiative.
Well, One Baltimore is a sort of put together to coordinate what's going on here in the city. When it comes to job training, what can you say about that, Michael Cryer?
Well,
identifying where job training takes place, I know from my own experience in dealing with ex-offenders, it's not that easy to find job training.
Well, that's true. I don't think that certainly I wouldn't disparage all of the job training that has occurred, and there are many people who are working as a result of it. But I do think that there is a real value in the kind of jobs that we're talking about. People have a sense that there is a career, there's a pathway. It's not makeshift work, and that's a difference where people start to buy homes and they start to have families because they do see a pathway to sustainability. I think that's a material difference in some of the kinds of work that we're talking about.
Don thinks you're another program. You said at the outset that you're not another program. And you're not a campaign, One Baltimore. You're here to identify assets, you say, and coordinate them.
That's right. I mean, we're not running these programs. I'm articulating what programs exist and how we tie them together and what the value is.
I don't remember exactly what Munir Bahar said about total failure of all those programs. People like to say this all the time, that all these government programs that have come along over the last, 50 years since the Great Society have been a total failure. That's not true. They lifted a lot of people out of poverty into the middle class and beyond. We never account for those folks. It's those who are left behind who are concentrated, mired in poverty now, and can't seem to get beyond that we're talking about.
That's true.
About
it's
now.
Easy to say, and we're left with the work of trying to figure out what we do with the circumstances we have right now.
Michael in Pasadena, you're on Midday Next. Hello.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had one basic question, and then depending on your guest's answer, I had maybe a couple of follow-ups, if that's all right.
Okay, sure.
Mainly, I was just thinking, since crime seems to be a really bad symptom of, but also a major contributor to a lot of the economic problems that are going on in Baltimore right now, Are there any programs that are perhaps targeted specifically at current criminals to get them to stop doing crime, as opposed to maybe people who have left jail and are trying to fix their lives a little bit?
That's a good question. I can help you with the answer to that. But Michael, the issue of ex-offenders, this was sort of my eye-opener in 2005 when I wrote a column in The Sun saying I was really sick of the killings. We had another surge that summer. Mm-hmm. Jeez, how many times have we gone through this? But anyway, I didn't know what to say about it. I was so angry. You know, I think three or four people were murdered on a Monday night. I wrote a column saying, stop killing each other. Put the guns down this summer. If you need help finding a job, give me a call. I put my phone number in the column. And I'm not exaggerating. 7,000 phone calls later, over the next maybe 2 years, I was still getting phone calls. And I'm still today. I could go to my voicemail at the Baltimore Sun and find a call from somebody who's looking for a job. I just got home. Oh, my brother just got home from prison. And as far as intervening on the street, that's a great idea. The police department actually had a unit called Get Out of the Game.
That's right.
They had a Get Out of the Game unit. I don't know if it's still functioning anymore. I guess I ought to check up on that. But cops would go out in the street and talk to people who, you know, were potentially going to be arrested and speak to them directly and then offer them a way to get out.
That and the program called Ceasefire. I don't know if you're familiar with
Ceasefire. Ceasefire is like that, right?
It's like that, yeah, where Ceasefire actually invites an offender into a room.
Or several at a time, a call-in. Yeah.
Yeah. And part of the strategy was to, every time one of them would create a problem, others would pay for it. And so they would take away some aspect of privilege. And so there are programs, obviously, that are directed to this, but I'm not the expert on those kinds of programs at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I know I direct people when I get these calls now. Mm-hmm. I direct them to the few organizations that work with ex-offenders, people who have come home from prison.
Open Society
it's a big issue with them.
That's right, yeah. And they're very involved in that.
Goodwill does it. There's several. In fact, by the way, if you're listening to me now and you want this information, contact me at the Baltimore Sun, because I typed it all up. I have a file on those programs. I even know some companies that make an effort to hire ex-offenders, too.
That's right. Johns Hopkins does a very good job at that. They're working at that quite well, and we're one of the ways that we're building this platform for collaboration on this issue is to... The White House is asking us to consider forming a reentry council so that we can put a number of these organizations together to work on what we do with ex-offenders who are returning to
Well, that
to
would
home.
Be great. Yeah. So many ex-offenders return to Baltimore zip codes.
That's right.
It's needed here. Two last things I just want to say about that, because it's a subject I'm really interested in. Mm-hmm. When he was governor, Robert Ehrlich and his state Public Safety Secretary Marianne Saar had this idea to get started on all this while men and women were still in prison.
Absolutely.
To better prepare them to come out so they just don't get on a bus at Hagerstown and come back to Baltimore and try to find a place to live, trying to find a way to see a doctor if they need to, try to find a job, to get all that started while they're still in the pipeline. It didn't work out because the Democrats in Annapolis didn't want to give the governor his way on that, but it still needs to be done. Not much has been done in that regard.
One of the examples I didn't share with you was a gentleman who was in prison for 16 years, has two gunshot wounds still in him, had been stabbed several times, went through this certification training.
For a tech job?
Yeah, he's now a master developer at Google.
Really?
You know, so I'm saying the potential.
He's one of ours? You mean he's from Maryland?
He's from Maryland.
But is he
working
here?
For Google. Working here, and some are out of town and have moved on because of their ability to move up in these administrations, these companies. So,
did he go to a community college? How did he?
I'm not
do
sure
that?
Of that. He was not a college grad, but he obviously got some skills in prison.
Mm-hmm.
He came out and took the classes and. And he's got a life,
right.
You know, he's got
it's
a real
good
life.
To know. So he got some of the training behind the walls.
I think he did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maryland has managed to drop its recidivism rate. That is, you know, its rate of people who return to the Department of Corrections within 3 years of their release because they get in trouble again. We haven't been able to bring that down to 42-43% or something like that. Mm-hmm. It was up in the 60s percent. And nationwide, it's still a problem. Right. We have to take a break. Michael Cryer is our guest from One Baltimore. Please call us if you want to contribute to our conversation here. We'd like to hear your thoughts about this. Baltimore in recovery. From your perspective, your viewpoint, do you see Baltimore recovering? Are you worried about what's going to happen in the coming months? Are you looking for a way to volunteer and help out with some of these efforts? 410-662-8780. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. City officials have suspended operations of the Safe Streets Anti-Violence Program in East Baltimore after some police officers found 7 guns and drugs stashed inside the Monument Street office of that program. This is, I'm quoting here from the Baltimore Sun. It's such a shame because Safe Streets does some great things in our community. I've written about it, Safe Streets program in Park Heights, intervening to keep people from killing each other.
That's right.
In Cherry Hill, in the zone covered by the Safe Streets program under the Department of Health in Baltimore.
They went a year without a
homicide there. And then you've got this situation on the east side and the suspended program again, the grant-funded Safe Streets program. And Michael Cryer, you believe at One Baltimore that Safe Streets ought to be, what, expanded? That it should be additional programs around the city?
Well, I think before we decide that to chuck the program, we ought to do a little bit of analysis because the work that they've been doing has been exceptional. It is a severe blow, no question, because many of us were advocating very strongly for expansion of that program.
It's an intervention program.
And that's right.
They're interrupters.
That's right.
And it depends on, part of the model is ex-offenders who know people in the streets, who know neighborhoods, hear things that are going on and find ways to interrupt violence.
That's exactly right. And they were doing a pretty good job of it. They knew the people. They could anticipate what looked like those issues and matters that would escalate to violence and were able to mitigate those and to, in many cases, to reduce them. And they knew the language. They knew the people. And so I hope that we discover that that those violations are limited because it was It was quite productive.
It's got to be a question of supervision or something there.
Something's got to be there.
I don't know what's going on.
I know that the public will tolerate
that's much too, more. It's too good of a program to let a couple of guys ruin it.
Hopefully it's limited to a couple of guys.
It's really a shame. Mm-hmm. So we'll follow up on that another day. But anyway, right. Speaking with Michael Cryer from One Baltimore here, here's a question that came in from the suburbs from one of our listeners, Abby, who says, how can a typical suburbanite help? Many of us want to.
Oh, well, that's great. You know, we have many, many mentoring opportunities. And I think one of the quickest, easiest, most meaningful ways is to establish a mentoring relationship, preferably not short term. We find that those that are most successful extend over long periods of time where a relationship develops. We have we have boys and girls clubs. We have all sorts of mentoring programs in Baltimore and around the region.
Is the idea that people can go to your website, One Baltimore, and discover all these things, read about them?
Well,
is that part of your plan?
At some point, I'm not so sure. You know, I think we may want to direct people to those resources. But eventually, we don't have that website up and running at this point.
No, you don't, but it seems to me it's like a one-stop shop,
We should be able to have the platform to do that and to direct them to those resources that would be most helpful.
If you want to read to a kid after school,
here's the program.
Contact
here's
this
the
program, and they'll send you to Cherry Hill Elementary School
That's exactly right. Yeah,
okay.
That's exactly right.
And then we received an email from Alexander Toprak, who is on the adjunct faculty at Morgan State University's School of Architecture and Planning, and wanted to ask about how historic preservation and building rehabilitation could be used as a tool for workforce development. And actually, I'm glad he wrote in about this because I wanted to ask you about housing in Baltimore City. State Senator Catherine
Pugh has a wonderful.
She was on the show last week, and she said, "You know, she said, Rodericks, you got to help me with the vacant house program. We have to bring the vacant house program back." long time ago, in the 1970s, early 80s, William Donald Schaefer was mayor, and we had the dollar house program. People could buy a vacant house for a buck as long as they committed to rehabilitating it and living there for, I think, 10 years.
Well, the senator has, I think, a great idea by connecting this to this universe of young college kids.
The millennials.
The millennials.
Even those just coming out of college.
That's
right?
Right. We invest lots of money and lots of resources in developing our young kids, and many of them move away. But one of the ways we can keep them and one of the ways we can help restore some of our neighborhoods is to make those homes available at essentially no cost, providing low-cost loans and what have you, and giving them abatements on taxes for a period of time. I think that's a really smart idea, and apparently quite a few of the college presidents also think so, and we hope that gets real traction.
So maybe we'll see a pilot program again? I'm going to call the housing department and ask this question, because it comes up every time we talk about vacant houses in Baltimore. Someone will call up who remembers the Schaefer administration, and they say, hey, what about the dollar houses?
That's right.
Homesteading. Why can't we do that again? I remember when whole blocks would be chain-linked. There'd be a chain-link fence around a whole block, and then they would have I don't know if it was first come, first serve. You had to make the commitment
to
rehabbing the house and living there.
Yeah, you got these 3% or 7% loans or something really inexpensive, and they were very effective.
And that's some great and stable. Did you get one?
I did one in 78. We bought a house. Well, there wasn't a dollar house, but we committed to the renovation. So
did you buy it from the city?
No, I didn't buy it from the city. It was a less expensive home, but we did take advantage of the renovation money that was available, and quite a few of us at that time bought homes and built a community.
Right, I know. Some of them, we could mention several of them that are in place still today and pretty stable.
Absolutely.
Let's go to John in Baltimore. Take another call. John, welcome to the show.
Yes, my concern is that Baltimore is becoming a city of cowards, and I say that to say that the first thing that has to be done is the citizens in these communities of high crime need to step up and take care of the crime in their neighborhoods by helping the police and helping the politicians, because the politicians and the police cannot do it by themselves. It's going to take the people in these communities who are afraid and using the word snitch as a veneer to hide behind so that they can't do what they're supposed to do to protect their children and the citizens in their own communities.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, John, before you go. Do you think some people are just legitimately afraid of the police, or just too angry, don't want to have anything to do with them?
I don't think people are afraid of the police. That is another excuse they're using to do nothing. They're using that as a way to say, I can't go to the police with these problems because the police is not going to help help me in the situation. They got to first help themselves. And they know where the criminals are. They know who the criminals are. They know where the criminals are. And I deal with it on the block that I live on every day when I come home and see people selling drugs in a public park across the street from my house. And every day I got to deal with seeing these children that everybody in the neighborhood knows where they live, who they are, and do nothing. Baltimore is a city of cowards.
Okay. What do you do about that, though? Have you called the police?
Yes. Every chance I get.
Did they respond?
Yeah, they respond, but it needs to be consistent. Now, this is the third neighborhood I've lived in Baltimore, and I must say the first two I lived in had the same problem, and they got rid of the problem by myself calling, my fiance calling on a regular basis. They did get rid of the problem, but for some reason, in where I am right now, they're not focusing on being consistent with getting that small problem out of a nice neighborhood.
What part of town are you in?
Reservoir Hill.
Okay, and one last question. Do you allow, John, for some people who are just afraid of, you say cowards, but legitimately afraid of repercussions if someone finds out that they call the cops?
You call anonymously. I mean, if it's traceable back to the person, I can understand that. But you just make a phone call. Mm-hmm. You're in your house, you make a phone call. You have the option to not have the police speak to you when they come to the scene.
That's right. That's true on 911 and on 311. Yeah. All right, John. Thank you very much for saying that. What do you think about what he said, Michael?
I don't know what to add to that. I mean, I think he's right. I mean, obviously, people have to step up, and if we are invested in our communities, we have to take the risk. I understand, though, the risk, because there are consequences. We know that that many who snitch, as he says, but we cannot expect to make progress if people don't invest, as he suggested.
There's a logical line there. Mm-hmm. That grows out of all the questions about the broken or fractured relationship between Baltimore police and people who are very close to the war on drugs and, you know, are in neighborhoods that see police a lot, right? That if the relationship with the police was better, it would follow there'd be less crime because people would be more willing to report crime, right? And I don't know that it's always a given that some people are just afraid to step up.
Well, that's true. And in one case, I think it's true, too, that many people don't know the police in their community or in who work that area. I think very often, as people have said, if they're in the car or if you don't repeat the same policeman in the same area, they don't develop the kind of relationship that one might if they were.
Let's take another call while Michael Cryer is with us. This is Horace. Horace, welcome to the Midday Show.
Hi.
Go right ahead, Horace. What did you want to say?
What I want to say is we need Baltimore City police, fire, and teachers to live inside the city proper. I'm tired of seeing all these policemen coming from Harford County, Pennsylvania. They have no allegiance to the city. I've heard teachers say, well, the city is so rough, I can't stand it. Well, if you don't like it, get out. Take your job. Take it somewhere else. We need people who are going to stay in the city. Firemen, if they're in the city, they're not going to see all this rubbish that's everywhere. They have a vested interest in the city. But these politicians, no one wants to tackle. Okay. None of them.
All right. Thank you very much. The Midday staff is actually looking into this subject because one of the things we're curious about is if you did that, would it make a difference?
Right.
Would you recruit better officers? Would you have reductions in crime? Would you see reductions in crime? Or is what you were talking about a better idea? Even if you live in Stewartstown, Pennsylvania, but you're in the same neighborhood all the time, you're out of your car, you're on the beat, you know the folks, even if you don't live next to them. A lot of police officers don't want to live in the neighborhood that they patrol, right?
That's true.
You know, Philadelphia had this requirement,
mm-hmm.
And then they gave it up. They gave it up, it was negotiated away with the police union. I don't know. But there was not a stampede of officers dying to live in the Philadelphia suburbs.
Well,
it was just a trickle of officers who said, yeah, I've always wanted to live outside the city. I'm going to do it now because I can. Just something I picked up in doing some reading about it.
Yeah, well, especially now. I mean, we talk about these unattractive circumstances, and it makes it more difficult to attract the audience of folk to return. But I do think there is some real value in increasing the percentage of people who provide service to have a relationship of sorts that differs mm-hmm. from what we currently have now, whether you live here or whether you live or work here in a consistent basis. I think there's a kind of intimacy that has to be developed if we're to have those improved relationships.
You know, you said you had an incentive in 1978 from the city to help you with that vacant house that you restored,
right? That's right.
There's incentive programs in place now for city employees to live in the city. And I noted this in my column. I think I mentioned it on the air that the number of officers, police officers, choosing to live in the city to taking advantage of those incentives for their down payments on their houses doubled in the past year. It's not an enormous number. It went from 7 to 14. But that's for one fiscal year, that's pretty good.
That's a good number.
Michael Cryer, it's nice to have you on the show, and good luck further coordinating One Baltimore for the city. And keep us posted. If there's some way we can help you here on the show, please let us know.
I will. Okay? We didn't get to talk about all the other components, but it's a
start. There's a lot.
It's a lot to do.
Well, okay, have you come back another time?
That'll be fine.
Thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Dan.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning into our first hour today. It's another hour coming up of Midday on Media with David Zerowick, media critic from the Baltimore Sun. We'll take a break here for lunch. Brought to us today by the Kenilworth Farmers Market. Kenilworth Farmers Market, located next to Atwater's at the Shops at Kenilworth, open Tuesdays, 3:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m., May through November.